Also like to welcome you to Bridgewater. So good morning, Bridgewater. How are you this morning? You're like, how do we answer that? Do I say good? Because maybe I'm good, maybe I'm not good, but it's kind of friendly and kind of normal for us to say good. Whatever, we'll go with good. And you can talk with those close to you about how you maybe you're really feeling. But we're glad that you are here. Super glad that you decided to join us today. Before we get into this new teaching series, I just want to take a second and just highlight two things. One is a really cool thing that's happening here that this week we had to scramble a little bit. But there's a Starting Point class, and maybe you know about that class, maybe you don't. But there's a Starting Point class where we just talk a lot about faith questions and questions you may have about salvation, what that looks like. What does it look like to be a follower of Jesus? And we had a class that was set up to be at 10:45, and there were so many people, 24 people that were going to take it, that we didn't fit in the room, so we had to have two. So there's one going on right now at 9, and David was scrambling to this week to fill that and to make sure everything was good. So I just think that's cool to be a part of. A place not only do we have carnations, but people in process as well. And so that's happening right now. If you want to even say a little prayer at the moment, just that they're dealing with that, that is a pretty cool thing. And also, let me just say this for those of you who are either have kids or you care for kids in the pre-K to elementary age group, take advantage of the parent pack. And there's just something about giving tools to you, resources to you to help have those spiritual faith kind of conversations with your kids. I know you won't, and your kids won't connect with everything in that pack, but there'll be something, and it's just something to create a habit of where can your kids go to talk about faith? Hopefully at home is one of those places, and not just here, but at home as well. And so take advantage of those packs. They're free, which is even better, and you can enjoy those and put those to use. All right, commercial over. We'll get onto the real video here. Today, we get to talk about the greatest underdog story of all time. In fact, it's the underdog story by which all future underdog stories will be identified. And it happens to be one of my favorites, has to be one of my favorite stories in the Bible. And let me just say this. I am glad all of you are here. Ladies, hear me. I'm glad you're here, but men, I am extremely glad that you are here. Why? Because this is our kind of story. I cannot stress it enough. This is our kind of story. The military is involved. They're at the brink of war. They're face to face with their enemy. There's a super soldier of sorts. There's armor. There's slingshots. There's swords. There's death. There's victory for the good guys. And the worst of all bad guys gets his head chopped off in the end. Come on! It's time. This is our story. And we get to look at it. I cannot wait to get into it. But before we jump in, let me tell you a story about a kid named Don Kerwin. And Don is not a kid you've probably ever heard of before. He was actually in my student ministry when I was a student pastor in Trenton, New Jersey, over 25 years ago. And which is crazy to say. When I wrote this, I said 20 years ago. And then I went, oh, man. It's even been longer than that. I am older than I think, and here we go after 8:25. So it's been 25 plus years, maybe, since this particular occurrence. But anyway, Don was one of those kids that you probably wouldn't have been drawn to. In fact, he was a little developmentally challenged and a little bit behind and extremely awkward socially. But Don, the crazy part, he was a genius with the pencil. He could draw anything. With such detail with a pencil. He was a remarkable artist, and his family was very involved at our church, which means Don was pretty much at everything we did in student ministry. And one of the things that we did every year was we went to snow camp, Word of Life Snow Camp, and if you're familiar with Word of Life Snow Camp, part of the weekend is this big competition between churches. And I'm just going to say it, if there's a competition, we might as well win, right? I mean, that's why you compete. You compete to win. I know. All right. We're going to get email stuff. Signed it to david@bridgewater.com. Okay. But the fact is, we were there to win. That's what we were going to do. And there's all kinds of competitions and tournaments throughout the weekend. One of those tournaments was a co-ed volleyball tournament. And we had a pretty big team. And so that meant that we had to rotate, like the front line rotated out as the server rotated in. If you played volleyball, that makes sense. If not, go with me. And so that's kind of how it happens. And we were doing pretty well. In fact, we found ourselves in the championship game. And in this championship game, of course, now there's not as much to do, not a bunch of games going on, just one. There's a lot more people, the crowd, all of our student ministry and leaders and from our church were there cheering us on. There's a lot more hype going in to this thing. And as the game is developing, it's kind of going back and forth. No one's really taking charge. It's just back and forth. And of course, if you play volleyball, again, this is a championship level, I don't know if I can express it enough, that the pressure is getting bigger. Because every point matters at this point, and no one's really taking charge. And it gets to this, we got the side out we needed. And it's our turn to serve for the championship point. And one of our best servers subs out. And you know, because I brought his name up earlier, Don subs in. And with that, our team's heart sank. You could see it, feel it, probably taste it. And someone even asked me if we could sub around him. If we could just skip him in the rotation, it'll be okay. It's championship point. And I'm not going to say I didn't think about it. That would be wrong. That'd be a lie. But we didn't make that change. And Don stepped up to the line to serve. Now, I know you've never heard of Don. But you have heard of the shepherd boy turned errand boy or delivery boy, David, who stepped up to face down the giant Goliath. And you may be wondering, that's just a kid's story. We know the story. Why are we camping out here? Why would we take so many weeks, several weeks, next five total weeks, to talk about this story of David and Goliath? And the truth is, I think one of the reasons is because this is our story. In a lot of ways, this is the story that we face every day. And I bet we could bring up person after person here, story after story, of the giants that we've faced, and whether we're still struggling with those giants or whether we've conquered some of those giants. The fact is that they keep rearing their ugly heads every once in a while. That we could do that. And the truth is, we'd love to hear those stories. In fact, we have a way to do that. This is great. I don't know, most of you probably have one with you. And if you can figure out how to turn the camera around to face you, we would love to hear you. Just take a story. Or you can ask your teenager to film you. That's fine too. But the fact is, we'd love to hear your story about how you've done it. Just a minute worth. And you can go to the website and click the bwater/your story and upload that to us, because we'd love to hear your story. Because we've all faced giants. Giants that taunt us whenever they can, and a lot of times paralyze us from the life that God has for us. And today I want to go into 1 Samuel 17 and take a look at what God's word has to say about how we can face those giants as we look at the story of how David encountered the giant Goliath. So go ahead and grab your Bibles or your phone and go to the Bible app. You can either turn or scroll then to 1 Samuel 17. And let's get into the story of David and Goliath. And as you're turning there, to catch you up to speed, we have the Philistines, and they're not new. They're not a new foe. They were in generations of battle with God's people. The two armies would often clash and go back and forth. And many times, Israel would lose those battles, suffering all kinds of defeats. In fact, if you jump back several chapters in 1 Samuel 4-7, you read of an encounter where they had a battle with the Philistines and lost 4,000 men. And the very next battle, just a few verses down, it's probably the next battle, they lost 30,000. That's when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant. And it's remarkable, and we can't go into it today, but man, it's just a good story how what God did even through those incredible losses. But here they are years later in 1 Samuel 17, and they have this time they think they have a secret weapon. So let's take a look at 1 Samuel 17. We're going to start in verse 3. It says this: "So the Philistines and Israelites faced each other on opposite hills, with the valley in between them. Then Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, came out from the Philistine ranks and faced the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. He also wore bronze leg armor and carried a bronze javelin on his shoulder. The shaft of his spear was heavy like a thick weaver's beam, tipped with an iron spearhead that weighed 15 pounds. His armor bearer walked ahead of him carrying the shield." Right at the beginning of this particular round with the Philistines, the villain shows himself. And he's a problem for the Israelite army. Now, I know that you hear, and we've talked about it, maybe you heard this story since you were a little kid, or maybe you hear the fact that he's over 9 feet tall, and that really doesn't make sense of size and all that kind of stuff. So I really did bring this ladder out here just to give you some perspective, because I really wanted you to understand how big or what he may have been doing that day. So I'm saying, again, before we get too crazy and look down on the army of Israel, this is, I know, the Giants Must Fall series, not the Kevin Must Fall series, so I will be careful. But this is what they were facing. This is what came out. A human being this big came walking out, full of armor, a giant of a man. Ginormous, really. And here's the thing. If you want, we can compare him to our very own David. David, why don't you come up? I mean, David's over there with the army of Israel. We do. So I don't know if you just want to compare. Again, just a visual. Pretty simple, a visual. The fact is that we face giants. And those giants are going to be ginormous, and he is impressive, and he is his armor and his weaponry. Thank you very much. That's all. That was good. His armor and his weaponry are as impressive as they are terrifying, right? And this is what came out to meet him that day. And it shook them. He was a problem. Too big for them to handle. Now, we know how the story ends. And this is the tricky part of giving this series, because you're going to want to race ahead. But let me do this with me. Just push pause on that for a second, if you could. And let's just step into the shoes of the Israelite army. And let's just see what unfolds in their lives. Let's start in verse 8. It says this: Goliath stood and shouted taunts across to the Israelites. "Why are you coming out here to fight?" he called. "I am the Philistine champion, but you are only the servants of Saul. Choose one man to come down here and fight me. If he kills me, then we will be your slaves. But if I kill him, you will be our slaves. I defy the armies of Israel today. Send me a man who will fight me." And with that, Saul and the Israelites heard that. They were terrified and shaken. I think as we enter this story for the next several weeks, we're going to be tempted to feel and believe like we're David, the hero. However, even before he gets onto the scene, I think we connect more with the army of Israel. I think we probably connect more with what they are feeling and what they are doing, because out comes this giant. And we line up every day and we go to battle just because that's what we're supposed to do, just like the army does. And out walks this giant, and it could be whatever that giant is to you. Whether it is rejection or comfort or addiction or some attitude or something that has a hold of your life that continues. You know you've struggled with it in the past, and it speaks and raises its ugly head and taunts us, and it shakes us. And it causes us to do nothing. We can easily become demoralized and ultimately then hopeless. King Saul and his armies are terrified and they're shaken. None of them are willing to go and fight Goliath. And it continues. It's not just this moment. The passage says 40 days. 40 days. Days the giant came out morning and evening, had the same challenge. In 40 days, there was no response. 40 days, no one stepped up. 40 days, they hid and were terrified. No one willing to take the challenge. And again, I'm not so sure that we're very different. That day after day, when our giant speaks, it raises its ugly head, or when that habit continues to dominate you, or those thoughts continue to come to your head, it easily takes us out over and over again. And it stops us from responding. It overwhelms our thinking. And then the response is we do nothing. The truth is, King Saul and the Israelite army were missing something. Because they were looking at not only were they overwhelmed with the problem, but they were hopeless. They were missing something, and it wasn't a David. Hear that. It wasn't a David, but God's going to use David to show them. And we know David. David, at this point in his life, is not that most impressive of a figure. No offense, David. He's a boy that wasn't old enough to go to battle with the king. He wasn't old enough, so he stayed home and took care of the sheep, a job his older brothers reference and use against him. David is tasked with taking something to the battlefront in verses 17 and 18 to deliver some food to his brothers. And probably he had a report because nothing's happening for 40 days. I'm guessing King Saul isn't sending messengers back just to talk about the glories of the battle when zero is happening. And so, of course, people are wondering what's happening. And so David gets sent on this task, and he does as his father asks. And let's jump back into the story in verse 20. When he says this, he, David, arrived at the camp, and just as the Israelite army was leaving the battlefield with shouts and battle cries, soon the Israelites and the Philistine forces stood facing each other, army against army. David left his things with the keeper of the supplies and hurried to the ranks to greet his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion, comes out from the Philistine ranks. And then David heard him shout his usual taunts to the army of Israel. And as soon as the Israelite army saw him, they began to run away in fright. The army was ready. Today was going to be the day. They were hyped. There were battle cries. They were clanging their armor. They were ready to go. Here we are, face to face. And here comes the giant. And he yells those same taunts that he'd yelled 40 other days. And they retreat. And they run in fear. But David has a different perspective. David has a different response to all this. Verse 26, David asks the soldiers standing nearby, "What will a man get for killing the Philistine and ending this his defiance of Israel? Who is this pagan Philistine anyway that he should be allowed to defy the armies of a living God?" And right there, we see the difference between David and King Saul and his army. In that response, we see a difference. How does David assess the giant as he walks out? Did the giant get any less impressive? Did he get shorter? Did his armor not look quite as impressive? Was he not as terrifying? Were his taunts not as significant? Nope. Same taunts. But there's a difference. And I think this is interesting. I just picked this up as I was studying it this week. If you just look back with me to verse 8. The first time Goliath comes onto the scene in verse 8, he says, "As Goliath stood and shouted a taunt across Israelites, 'Why are you coming to fight?' he called. 'I am the Philistine champion, but you are only servants of Saul.'" The giant lied to them, and they believed it. The giant told them that they were only servants of Saul, but the truth was they weren't only servants of Saul. They were in the army of the living God. And that was the key to defeating this giant. And I think that's a key to defeating our giants. We are face to face with the giants. We can listen to the lies because they're overwhelming. And we can believe them. And we forget who we are. And we think that we're too small or not enough or a failure waiting to happen, whatever your giant taunts you. Because there's this truth that who or what we depend on really do determine what we do. King Saul and his army compared their strength and their size to the size of Goliath. And it paralyzed him to do nothing. And the big idea from this story isn't that you should try harder to roll up your sleeves and get to work to get better with your effort. The big idea is that God extends his grace and favor towards us and allows us to experience what he can do through us, for us. He can put a new way of thinking in our hearts. He can transform our minds and put us on the right path. David knew the truth that they should have known. David held on to the truth that they should have been holding on to. Just listen to how he doubles down when he responds to the king in verses 32 to 34. He says this, "Don't worry about the Philistine," David said to Saul. "I will go fight him." "Saul, don't be ridiculous," Saul replied. "There's no way that you can fight this Philistine and possibly win. You are a boy and he's been a man of war since his youth." Love the first three words of verse 34. But David persisted. No. Let me tell you about two things that were remarkable that happened. "Oh man, I was watching my father's sheep. And in the process, a lion came and took. And one other day, a bear came and took a sheep. And I went after that bear." And you know what he doesn't tell him? He doesn't tell him about his strategy, how he snuck up on the bear and the skill that he used and all those things. But he tells them. He tells him how he rescued the lion and the bear. And that's impressive. Clearly impressive. Because probably I would have gone, "Hey, only one sheep, not bad. We got others." But listen to how David sums up the experience. Listen to how David talks about it as he ends this story in verse 37. He says this, "The Lord who rescued me from the claws of the lion and the bear will rescue me from this Philistine." David has always been relying on God. Certainly he had skills. But he knew that God had done on his behalf, rescuing him from the lion and the bear. And he was confident that God was going to do it again. Because who he depended on changed what he did. Saul then, in the story, as you know, reluctantly gives his go-ahead. And David heads towards the battlefield. And I imagine that as the Israelite army is behind whatever they're hiding behind, or you know, their conversations that are happening, and all of a sudden somebody sees something, someone walking down to the battlefield. I'm sure it got all of their attention because they certainly knew about who the enemy was. They certainly knew about his power. And I'm guessing their hearts sank a little when they realized it was David, the boy who had come. Because they knew he had no chance to win. Yet none of them ran to bring him back, and none of them ran to his aid. So David steps up to the line to fight the giant. And in the pressure of the volleyball championship point, with its teammates giving a resigned encouragement, the other team, I think, breathed a little sigh of optimism. Don stepped up to the line to serve championship point. A line that he had repeatedly failed at throughout the entire tournament. He hadn't made one serve over the net. Don held the ball. And I can tell you, because this is just how I remember it, that the thing moved in slow motion. And I'm thinking there's some sort of music building in the background, because Don lines up to strike the ball, strikes the ball sails, just clears the net enough to let the first line people let it go by, but not enough for the second line people to come up, and the ball hits the ground. Don had served a championship point ace. Let me try that again. Oh, you got to cheer. This is something that's happened. I'm telling you right now, people. Don served a championship point ace, and the crowd, yes, went crazy. Not only that, but it rushed him. And I heard one of the students standing next to me, because I was actually next to Don, the student standing here, that another student said, "There is a God." And they rushed Don and picked him up on his shoulders. It was the most, I think, probably the greatest underdog story I've ever been a part of. And we're grateful that God used the unlikely to remind us and show his favor to us. David steps up, and we know how this goes. David steps up against the giant, and the giant comes out and tries all of his old tricks and taunts. David's going into the battle not as a more skilled soldier, that's for sure. He is way behind on the tail of the tape here. He did have some skills. We know that because we talk about his stories and he played a mean harp, but I don't know that that's going to help him in this case. But look how he responds to the giant's taunts in verse 45 to 47. David replied to the Philistine, "You come at me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of heaven's armies, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. Today the Lord will conquer you, and I will kill you and cut your head off. And then I will give you the dead bodies of your men to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. And everyone assembled here will know the Lord rescues his people, because not with the sword or the spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you to us." Rah, right? Come on. That's what's happening. And you know what? When it happened, we know what happens. The fact is that David knew the battle wasn't his. He knew it was in the gods. And the thing is, David isn't the hero here. David isn't the hero here. God is the hero here. David knows it's God's battle. He repeats it over and over again. And we know how the story ends. The giant moves closer to attack. I'm guessing he's really angry at this point after that comment from David, this little dog that comes at him. And David runs to meet him. I cannot love that more. And he grabs a stone and puts it in his sling, and he lets it rip, striking the giant in the forehead. And the verse says the stone sank in. And it stops the giant in his tracks, and he wobbles him a little bit, and he tries to shake it off. Then he falls on his face dead. And then David runs up to this dead face down giant, grabs his own sword and pulls it out and chops the giant's head off. Fellas, this is our story. So glad that you were here. And with that, the army of Israel freaks out, erupts, and rushes the battlefield, something they should have done in the beginning. And they're just amazed at what God did. And how God used the unlikely to remind them of how big he truly is. David and everyone knew that he was outmatched. But David knew that God was bigger than Goliath. David's hope and dependence were on God to rescue, God to deliver, God to fight, and God to win. Our hope and dependence need to be on God as well. I understand that your giants, whatever they are big. I get it. They're overwhelming. I understand. I hear voices in my head as well. Don't take that too far, but I do. Insecurity, rejection, whatever the case may be, I don't know what it is for you. They're big. And we're going to face them, and there will be them in the future. But the point of the story is that they're not bigger than God. So as we unfold and we talk about the giants of fear and rejection and comfort and addiction in the next several weeks, I hope you can do something when you hear this underdog story of how amazingly big our God is, much bigger than a ginormous giant. I want to challenge you to do something, and this is going to sound so simple and so easy to say in church. I'm going to challenge you to trust God. Whenever you face the problems, the obstacles, to trust God. 1 John, I don't have a screen for it, but 1 John chapter 5, verse 4 says this, "For every child of God defeats the evil of this world, and we will achieve this victory through faith." I challenge you to trust God, and you say, "Kevin, that's really great. It sounds so nice. As a matter of fact, I make a great bumper sticker. My God is bigger than my problems." Or could say, "My God is bigger than your driving," whatever. So how do I do that? I'm super glad you asked. I think one way is that we shift our perspective and focus onto God, not the problems. Again, King Saul and the army could only see how much bigger the giant was than them. So we need to take a step back And remember how big our God is. Even in the midst of what we're facing. A way to do that. I'm going to challenge you to do this, to remember God's faithfulness. This week, I want you to throw out this challenge. I want you to write down 21 ways that God is faithful. And they're like, wow, 21, why 21? Well, I don't know, three a day. Seems it's doable. Nothing magical about 21. It's just, if you guys start having conversations about, boy, what would you write down? It might be who brought you to church for the first time or brought you back to church. Or maybe who introduced you to Jesus for the first time. That's God's faithfulness in your life. Maybe he helped you when you really needed it. I'm sure there are all kinds of stories, just like we could line up all kinds of stories of the giants we faced. We could line up all kinds of stories if you just took some time to think it through. Of how God's been faithful to you. My whole life has been one of the characterizations of my life in a humorous way, I guess, to some extent, is my fortune with cars. It's not great. And I remember my first, we're just married. I was, well, again, in New Jersey. And we had a little daughter, Kessid, and the car just suddenly quit. It was done. This problem was bigger than my budget. And I didn't know what we were going to do. And later that day, someone called the church, a guy named Dave McCann. He called the church and said, hey, I was wondering if you knew of anybody who needed a vehicle. I just bought a new one and wanted to donate mine to somebody who needed one. Say that again? Wait, what? That's going on my list. If I take time to remember it, it's 25 years ago. Those are the things that go into my list, and I'm excited to hear what happens on your list. As you go through and remember the things that our big God did for you, even if maybe they don't seem that big, but he showed himself faithful. And we're going to end our time this morning. There's probably no better way than to remember God's faithfulness, God, his love and favor for us, than to celebrate communion together. I mean, God loved us so much when we needed it the most. He was sent his son to rescue us from the giants of sin and death. And communion is just a great reminder of that. In fact, Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 verse 26 says this, that whenever you eat the bread and drink the cup, you announce or proclaim the Lord's death until he returns. It's bringing up the fact, a reminder of the fact, and not just a reminder for you, but a reminder for everybody, a proclamation that God loves us to an extreme extent, and he is bigger than our sin and bigger than death. He beat it. And we have that victory because of our big God. So I want to invite all of you who will consider yourself Jesus followers to go ahead and grab that cup. And again, for those of you in here that aren't Jesus followers yet, that's just not how you, we're glad you're here, but do me a favor, just sit back and watch. It's okay. This really was a reminder that Jesus gave to his followers. And I would love to talk with you later about what it means to be a follower of Jesus. But if you have that cup, go ahead and take the bread side up. Peel that layer back off. In that same passage in 1 Corinthians, Paul is reminding the believers of what it means, his communion. It says this in verse 23, "For I pass on to you what I received from the Lord himself. That on the night he was betrayed, the Lord Jesus took some bread and he broke it and gave thanks for it. He broke it into pieces and said, this is my body given for you." I hope you hear the personal you there. Jesus' body broken and given for you, me. Do this in remembrance. So they can flip the cup over there, take off that tab. Paul continues in verse 25. He says, listen, in the same way, Jesus took the cup. He said, this cup is a new covenant between God and his people, an agreement confirmed by my blood. Do this in remembrance of me as often as you drink it. And I'm going to just pause for a second. I'm going to ask that you bow your heads and close your eyes, because I want you to know, when you read the do this in remembrance of me, I think that this isn't just eating the bread and drinking the cup. This is the proclamation of Jesus' death till we come. It's remembering those things. It's announcing those things. It's remembering every time we eat and drink. The band's going to come, but I'll close this in prayer. Pray with me. Lord, I just want to thank you. Thank you for this reminder of your love for us. We certainly came off Easter Sunday where we certainly talked about these very same things, but it's just a great reminder that you loved us and were willing to do whatever it took to beat the giant of sin and death on our behalf. We're grateful. Lord, thanks for being a bigger God than the things that seem overwhelming to us. Help us to remember you. Help us to trust you. Help us as we go tomorrow or this afternoon and face those very giants to put our trust in you. And ask that in your son Jesus' name. Amen.